Today I'm going to do the monster calculation at classical level, where I go from this action to the action involving zeta gamma that I wrote down last time. And we can do it kind of quickly because many of the details are deferred to the problem set. So I'm just going to write down some key points in the calculation. And there's one step in particular that is kind of tricky. There's a cancellation that's hard to find. And so I wanted to go through that step instead of putting it in the problem set. I sort of suspect that there might be a better way to do this calculation since there's one step that's so strange. Okay, so the first step is just taking this action and expanding it in the ADM variables in a 3 plus 1 dimensional notation. And the so this is part A of the problem set. I found it convenient to use define Eij to be n, the ADM variable, times the extrinsic curvature, so that Eij is this. E is the trace of Eij. Then step B is to specialize the background metric to FRW. Let me put. So in step B, I specialize the background metric to a perturbed FRW metric, where Hij is the perturbation. And I went ahead and used the gauge condition delta phi equals 0 here. This is only one gauge condition out of four, and the other ones we'll do in a subsequent step. In those variables and with the gauge condition applied, the action ends up looking like this. It's interesting that this calculation is a big mess for a while, and then it collapses in the end to something simple, which makes me wonder if there's some better way of doing it. But the way that I'm doing it is the simplest way that I was able to find when I was putting the lecture notes together. The delta Eij, so I've defined delta Eij and delta E just by expanding Eij and E around the background. So delta Eij is Eij minus its value in the background, which is H times the 3 metric. I want to try to simplify the action as shown in the form B. And this is the step that involves the strange cancellation. So one step which is straightforward is to replace the H where it appears by using Friedman's equation, I can replace the uh, term containing H, and I get one little cancellation here. Something that's oh yeah, one more step. Now I'm gonna start trying to expanding this to quadratic order. I'll define n equals the idiom variable n is one in the background, so I'll define the perturbation variable psi, first order perturbation. So you write this as so it's sort of useful to stare at this expression and just see which order in perturbation theory all of the terms are. So one subtlety is that the term this term and this term are both second order. Even though this term appears to have one more power of the fluctuation, psi is a first order perturbation. And that's true for the following reason. It's not obvious, but it's true for the following reason. First off, note that the spatial curvature R3 is equal to 0. In this FRW background, the four curvature is non-zero. The four curvature of an FRW background is generally non-zero. But if I slice the background on a spatial slice, then so that the metric just looks like A squared delta IJ, then A depends on time, but not space, so that single slice considered on its own has zero curvature. When I perturb the metric to first order, give it a perturbation hij, then the spatial curvature R3 gets a first order perturbation, as you can see by looking at our results on perturbation theory. If I integrate it, the first order perturbation goes away, since to first order, so delta R3 would be non-zero. If I perturb the metric, the spatial curvature gets some correction of order h. But if I this is like a three-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action. If I vary this integral, then some integrations by parts occur, and the result is, I think there's a minus. And since the Einstein tensor, the three-dimensional Einstein tensor, I guess I should write this with ij since it's a spatial metric. You know, this is zero because the background is flat. And so this guy this integral doesn't contain a first order correction in H, even though R3 on its own would. Most of the terms here are second order, like the quantities with delta are first order perturbations. So this is second order. This whole thing is second order. These pieces are second order. This piece is second order. Now the thing that's confusing is that we expected on, and this is where I got stuck for a bit when I was doing this calculation. We expected on general grounds, when we expanded the action in perturbations, not to find any terms that were first order in the perturbations. And it's really non-obvious how that cancellation is going to work. So if I collect just the first order terms, then get these guys. So here the only first order term is minus 4h delta e. This is a second order term. This term is zeroth order, but when I expand the square root g in fluctuations of the metric, I'll get a first order. That zeroth order term will get corrected by a first order term. So these are all the first order terms. So somehow, it must happen that they cancel to zero if there are no algebra mistakes. With the definition of delta e here, involving time derivatives of the metric and these covariant derivatives. But it's really hard to see how that cancellation actually happens. So I got it to work. By the following sequence of steps. If I start with this expression, and then plug in, I'm going to plug in the definition of delta E. Two terms. One comment is that since we're working in the gauge where delta phi is zero, a quantity that depends on phi, like v, is a function of time only. It doesn't get, in other words, it's equal to the zeroth order value it would have in the background. It doesn't get perturbations. I meant to say that, but I forgot. Okay. So I want to somehow simplify this and get something that looks like this term. This term does integrate to zero. All of the g's here are g3s. I won't write the g3, just everything's been unpacked into a 3+1 dimensional notation, and there are no 4s. This integrates to zero just because it's part of some tensorial expression with a covariant derivative. There's no, the only thing you might wonder is whether since this factor depends on time, whether when you integrate by parts you get a derivative there. But this is just You can think of the d4x like this, where inside I just have some spatial three integral where everything is covariant. It's a covariant derivative. So this term cancels. For this term, what I did is I wrote hij. And then differentiated both sides. Then if I plug that in, I get this when I contract the GIJ with the GIJ. And then the step that I thought was really strange is if you stare at this, you see that you can use Jacobi's rule for differentiating a determinant, like in reverse. Let me write it this way. By Jacobi's rule, this is the time derivative of square root g. And I sort of have all the factors that I need here to apply it in reverse. So I get this weird looking expression. I can integrate by parts in the first term. Bring the square root g3 out. Make it minus h dot. That's 3h squared. And then using Friedmann's equations, if you combine Friedmann's equations, this combination of h dot and h dot squared is v over m Planck squared. So this simplifies to minus 1/2 integral d4x square root g3, which is exactly what you need to cancel the linear term over here. This was what I was calling minus 4 I. So this whole combination of terms ends up being zero. So if not for that trick, I might have just made the whole thing a homework problem. But I thought this was just really, the step was just really odd. Anyway, after that step, the action has a form which is manifestly second order in all of the fluctuations. So, So now the only step is, so far we've only used one of the gauge fixing conditions out of four, and we also have not eliminated the non-dynamical ADM variables, n, which we now call psi, the fluctuation variables, and ni, which is hidden in the definition of Eij. I'll next summarize. Once you get the action in this manifestly second order form, then the next step is to apply the gauge fixing conditions. So if I write the metric like this, where gamma is traceless and satisfies this gauge condition. And then do some calculations which are parts C and D in the problem set. Then I can make the action look like this. It's the sum of a scalar and a graviton-like piece, where S2 is in the final form that we want. S0 still needs some work with the expression. This is the last long, ugly-looking equation. Let's see. I guess in the notes, I've organized this by how many powers of the non-dynamical fields appear. Conceptual step that we haven't done yet is eliminating the non-dynamical variables. Psi and ni. The way that you would do that, and this is part E of the problem set, is that you would calculate their equations of motion from this action. And those equations of motion will contain no time derivatives. They will contain spatial derivatives. Or rather, no time derivatives on the non-dynamical fields. And so you can solve the equations of motion to just get solve the equations of motion for psi in terms of and ni in terms of the non-dynamical fields. You get constraint equations instead of differential equations. The result for ni is a little ugly. The last step is just to plug these back in the action to get an action that only involves zeta. That's the only field left after plugging in these. equations for the non-dynamical fields. And so when you do that, everything collapses down. This is part F, to give this nice simple action. So this is a really famous foundational calculation in cosmology. This is called the Mukunov-Sasaki action. Let me write both terms. There's an action involving zeta, and then there's an action involving the gravity waves. And so as expected, this action has a single scalar degree of freedom zeta. Oh, sorry, this should be zeta dot squared. Should get a single scalar degree of freedom zeta and a two graviton-like degrees of freedom in gamma ij is the gauge condition here. This is the action that we're going to quantize to understand how the fluctuations are produced during inflation. One thing that's a little odd about this action is that so the inflaton is important in single field inflation, the fact that there's an inflaton, that it has a potential. But it seems to have disappeared in this action. You might wonder, where is the dependence in this action on the form of V of phi? It's hidden here. There's some time-dependent factor in the action, and to determine its time dependence, you need to solve the background equations of motion, which we wrote down last time, to get h during inflation and phi dot during inflation. The fluctuations in the inflaton seem to have disappeared too, and that's because we're just working in the gauge where delta phi equals zero. Sometimes people ask, when you talk about inflation, the textbooks will make statements like there's a scalar mode during inflation that gets excited. And sometimes you might ask, well, what is that a mode of? Is it the inflaton that gets an excitation? Or is it, as you might expect intuitively, or is it some components of the metric that get the fluctuation, as you might infer here from seeing zeta in the action, which is the trace of the spatial part of the metric? And it's just a gauge. The answer is that it's just a gauge-dependent question, which field is perturbed. We're working in a gauge where the surfaces of constant coordinate time are surfaces of constant phi. And so in that gauge, the perturbation shows up in the metric. If you wanted a gauge, independent way of thinking about it, a gauge invariant way of thinking about it, you could say that there are two time slicings. You could imagine when the perturbations appear, slicing the space-time on surfaces of constant phi, or slicing them on surfaces of constant curvature, constant spatial curvature, R3. We chose to work in the gauge where the phi fluctuation was gauged away, and there was still a spatial curvature fluctuation, which is our field zeta. But another gauge choice, which is sometimes made, is to work in the gauge where the spatial curvature R3 is constant, and then the action would involve phi, and in that gauge, the phi field has fluctuations. So it's the difference between those two time slicings, which is gauge invariant. That's a gauge invariant way of thinking about the quantity that we're calling zeta, the time delay between those time slicings. Okay. It's interesting. So this is a really important calculation, and it's sort of interesting that it ends in a relatively simple compact expression, and it also started from a very simple compact expression. This four-dimensional action was really simple. But in between, it's a total mess with mysterious cancellations and lots of work. And I have wondered if that is a symptom of there being a better way to do this. But this is the simplest way of doing the calculation that I know of, the version that I just presented. Okay. I wanted to go through that just so the action didn't just come out of nowhere, and you'll get to experience all the details on the problem set. From now on, this is going to be the action. We'll use the action in this form when we talk about inflation. Next, I want to, starting from that action, talk about quantizing the perturbations. Quantizing inflation. And what will happen is that if we quantize this action, this is a free quantum field theory. That's actually just an approximation we're making because we didn't try to compute the terms of cubic order in the fluctuations. Given the amount of algebraic pain involved in expanding to quadratic order, expanding to cubic order is obviously very difficult. And in fact, it was the first time it was done was done fully. Was in 2002 in a very famous paper by Maldacena. It's become like a landmark paper in the field. If you read that paper, it's really misleading because if you don't try to follow the calculations, it seems like it's a modest amount of algebra. But if you actually work through all the calculations in that paper, you'll fill like 50 pages trying to calculate everything. So it's just an approximation that we're making that we're just going to deal with the quadratic part for now. So it's going to be a free QFT, which means that we won't have to, we'll just be computing propagators, not diagrams. But computing the propagators is actually a little non-trivial because this QFT has explicit time dependence. And in particular, the time dependence is what's responsible for the particle production. So I want to just start by giving like a toy example of how particle production can happen in quantum mechanics with a time-dependent Hamiltonian, where that is a system can evolve from its ground state to an excited state. And that is a simple harmonic oscillator with time-dependent frequency. So this is just a problem in Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics. So I want to think about a harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent frequency. And I'll imagine that omega t goes to a constant at early times, which is a constant as t goes to t0. And that the oscillator is in its ground state at time t0. And I'll just try to solve for the state at time t. Qualitative statements you can make in advance are that if the time dependence of the frequency is slow, then there's a theorem in quantum mechanics that the system will stay in its ground state. So at any time, of course, the levels of the oscillator are of the form n plus 1/2 times whatever the omega at that time is. And if omega is changed adiabatically, meaning that omega dot is small compared to omega squared, then if we start in the unoccupied state, there's a theorem in quantum mechanics that we just stay, the wave function just stays locked into the ground state as the Hamiltonian changes. In the opposite limit where the change in the Hamiltonian is fast, like you could imagine discontinuously changing the frequency, then what you would expect to happen is that the wave function is frozen, so that the if I start with the ground state, the ground state for an oscillator with frequency of omega is has wave function e to the minus omega x squared over 2. If I discontinuously change omega, then what would happen is that the wave function stays the same. It doesn't have time to adjust to the change in the potential. And the new ground state would be something else. And so the oscillator would be in an excited state. That's sort of a theorem in quantum mechanics, but it just follows that if the Hamiltonian changes discontinuously, the wave function stays fixed. And that really just follows because the Schrodinger equation is a first-order differential equation. So if I change h discontinuously, the derivative of psi gets to change discontinuously, but not psi. So rapid change, rapid time dependence generally takes you from the ground state of a theory to an excited state. And what's going to happen over here is that this is a free QFT that starts in its vacuum state. And if the time dependence is rapid, which it is in inflation because the expansion is near exponential, it's a very dramatic expansion, then you produce a bunch of particles and end in a very excited state of the theory. Now to work through the details of this, one more equation that I forgot to write down that I'll use later is that at early times, when we're assuming the frequency is constant and the oscillator is in its ground state, we can define the usual ladder operators. And the initial wave function at time zero is annihilated by the lowering operator. I'm going to solve this equation in the Heisenberg picture. So let me just remind you that in the Schrodinger picture for quantum mechanics, the state evolves according to the Hamiltonian, according to Schrodinger's equation, where I wrote the Hamiltonian and Schrodinger's equation as H sub S to emphasize that it's a Schrodinger picture operator, and with the T to emphasize that it can be time dependent. I'll denote the unitary evolution operator that takes you from the state at time zero to the state at time T like this. Since the Hamiltonian is time dependent, I'm not assuming that's of the form e to the minus ih delta t. That's really why I wanted to write down these equations relating the Schrodinger and the Heisenberg picture, just because the first time I saw it in quantum mechanics, anyway, it was written with e to the minus ihts everywhere, and here I just want to use different notation. So in the Heisenberg picture, rather than evolving the state, we evolve the operator. So for any operator, the Heisenbergized operator or the Heisenberg picture operator is just defined by sandwiching it between if I have any Schrodinger picture operator that operates at time t, then if I sandwich it between two unitary evolution operators, that's the definition of the Heisenberg picture operator. And it's defined so that if I want to calculate an expectation value at time t, I can do it either in the Schrodinger picture like this, or in the Heisenberg picture by leaving the state in its initial state and putting the Heisenberg picture operator in there. Heisenberg picture operator just captures up the unitary evolution on both the cat and the bra and then puts in the Schrodinger picture operator. And the Heisenberg picture equation of motion is this for any operator. Guess I'm not putting hats. I'm going to put the hat here because it looks weird to have h sub h without the hat. There's also a term, I guess, since I'm allowing operators have time dependence, then I'll include a term in the Heisenberg equation of motion that accounts for possible time dependence of the operator. But this is going to end up being zero in all the examples that we consider. So you take the commutator. To evolve an operator in the Heisenberg picture, you take its commutator with the Heisenberg picture Hamiltonian. Would be defined by integrating one way to define it would be to say that I take its partial derivative with respect to time. That's minus ih. And the initial condition is that when t equals t zero, it's the identity operator. Okay. This operation of Heisenbergization, there's got to be a better word, commutes with multiplying operators together, where both A and B have to be evaluated at the same time. And same is true for commutators, of course. And this is a property that I use all the time without really saying so explicitly. In particular, one thing that's true in the Heisenberg picture is that this the equal time commutator of a x and a p is always equal to I. This is what's called the canonical commutator in quantum mechanics. The commutator of any anything with its conjugate momentum is always equal to I. And the reason that's true is that you can pull the h out, and then the Schrodinger picture operators have a commutator equal to I times the identity operator, and then nothing happens when I Heisenbergize them. So this equal time commutator I'm going to end up using sometimes. I didn't really use this board. Let's try to solve this. What are those definitions and properties? We can solve the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. So first I'm going to write down the Heisenberg picture equations of motion. So just to be really explicit about that step, the Schrodinger picture Hamiltonian is this. I left out the t's on the ps and the xs because those operators don't have any time dependence in the Schrodinger picture. In the Heisenberg picture, they would. So then, squared. Since Heisenbergizing an operator commutes with multiplication, the Heisenberg picture Hamiltonian is this. And now if I want the Heisenberg picture equation of motion for XH, say, then I just commute with the Heisenberg picture Hamiltonian. Plug that in. I keep forgetting squares. Now we just have to compute that commutator. So this commutator is zero because XH commutes with itself. And over here I can use the canonical commutator. So when I push this P, when I push these P's through the X, I pick up a factor of minus I. And so I get, let's see, there's the 1/2. There's a factor of 2 because I push two of them through. And then I get a minus I from the canonical commutator when P commutes through the X. And then I get a factor of P. So this ends up being... similarly... So let me write it over here. And similarly, if you calculate the Heisenberg picture equation of motion for pH, you get this. Bye. Using the Heisenberg equation of motion and canonical commutators. Now these are the same. Equations of motion that the classical variables X and P have. So the slogan is that Heisenberg picture operators have classical equations of motion. I just wanted to go through the definitions and show how that works formally. If you have, in this case, there were no ordering ambiguities on the right-hand side, but if the classical equations of motion had, xp squared, then you'd have to figure out how to order things in the quantum mechanical version, and then you might want to actually go through this whole procedure. In general, if there are no ordering ambiguities, then you can usually shortcut it just by writing down the classical equations of motion. Now, what about the initial conditions? At early times, we were assuming that omega was constant, equal to omega zero. And so the Heisenberg equations of motion at the initial time, we can write like this. So in the initial conditions, the Heisenberg picture operators x hat and p hat. I guess in these equations, I didn't put the subscript, but at the initial time t0, the Schrodinger picture and the Heisenberg picture operators are equal to each other. So if we start with x and p given by these operator equations, and then we evolve them forward in time with these operator equations, then we have some closed system of equations and we can try to solve. One thing that you can see is, if I start with an x hat and a p hat that are linear combinations of a and a dagger, some operators a and a dagger, and then I evolve them forward with these linear differential equations, then at every subsequent time t, I also get a linear combination of a and a dagger, where a and a dagger always mean the initial time operators. So there's just some coefficients here that I need to solve for. If in every time step I'm just adding something linear in what I had before, and I start with something linear in A and A dagger, then at every time I have something linear in A and A dagger. So to start constraining this solution, first I'll note that V must be equal to U star, since X hat is always Hermitian. More than one way to work through this, but this is how I did it. And the same is true for F and G. And then by the equation of motion, by this Heisenberg picture equation of motion, we have F equals U dot. Let's see, so putting those, I meant to put Heisenberg picture operators over here. I haven't used the Heisenberg picture equation of motion for P yet, but if I just put those statements in, then I can write the solution like this. Times A of T0. And finally, And then finally, I'll use the equation of motion for P. Which gives the function u satisfies the same equation of motion as the classical variable x. We're just interpreting it, instead of as a classical trajectory, as the coefficient of a ladder operator in the quantum mechanical solution. And the initial conditions are you can read the initial conditions off by matching these solutions with these guys at the initial time. I guess this should be t minus t0, but I wasn't keeping track of an overall phase in the notes. At this point, we can declare that we solved the time-dependent harmonic oscillator in the Heisenberg picture. That is, we have a differential equation with some initial conditions that we can solve if we have some specific form of omega of t. We can compute. Then we know the Heisenberg picture operators. That suffices to compute any expectation value of interest. If you want to compute the expectation value of x squared or x to the fourth or something, then you just put some number of powers of the Heisenberg picture operator in if you want the expectation value of time t. So next time I'll have a few more things to say about this, including how you would solve it in the Schrodinger picture, or how you would infer the solution in the Schrodinger picture. And then we'll talk about some QFT examples.